From Capitol Hill to our living rooms, there's plenty of disagreement about our politics. It's easy to think that when people make up their minds, there's no room to budge. But it turns out when you get people together in the right setting to talk about the big issues, people are more willing to change their minds than we might think. Our next guest has been doing that for years, a process he calls deliberative democracy. Last month, at an event called America in One Room, hundreds of people gathered in Dallas for a weekend of discussions about immigration, the economy, and more. Surveys taken before and after that event showed a potential for compromise and a growing faith in American democracy. James Fishkin is the Janet M. Peck Chair of International Communication and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University and the Director of the Center for Deliberative Democracy. He's the author of the book, Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, set the stage for us. America in One Room, 500-plus people gathering. Paint us a picture of what happened.
Well, the first thing to note is that this was a stratified random sample of the American public, meticulously recruited by the University of Chicago, NORC at the University of Chicago, which is probably the best academic survey research organization. So they went back and back to the people drawn in the sample until they could talk them into coming. So we had this microcosm of America all gathered together. And by the way, it was a controlled experiment. We had a separate group of 840 people who were a control group who didn't come to this big hotel in Dallas near DFW. They just stayed home. They took the survey at the time of recruitment several weeks before and then at the end of the weekend. And so we could see how the public was changing compared to how the people who deliberated changed. The public didn't change hardly at all, but the people who deliberated changed dramatically. They were randomly assigned to small groups. So the groups were diverse, maybe 40 small groups, 12, 13, 14 in a group, trained moderators who didn't give anything of their own opinion, but were trained to facilitate a civil discussion. And then we had briefing materials on the key issues facing the country, as identified in earlier polling. Those were immigration, health care, the environment, taxes in the economy, and foreign policy. And we had lots of proposals under each topic, maybe a dozen or so under each, and we had detailed briefing books, arguments for and against each proposal. We had a video version of the briefing. We had an executive summary version. And they discussed in depth in the small groups these issues. And then they decided as a group what were the most important questions that they needed to get answered from panels of competing experts, left, right, and center, who would answer the questions from their point of view. And then the people kept on deliberating throughout the whole weekend, and they worked from Thursday night until midday Sunday, and then they flew home. And they discovered that they could not only talk to each other, but listen to each other. And as they listened to each other, people really broke out of their filter bubbles. You know, most of the time when people discuss or think about politics or public policy, nowadays they're getting the information on their social media news feeds. They're tuning in to their favorite sources, whether it's cable television or talk radio or publications on the web. But they tend to seek out information that already confirms their viewpoint. And they may never hear the other side. They discuss with the like-minded. So in a way, this was an experiment about what would people think if they really talked under civil ground rules, if they really talked and listened to people very different from themselves.
And Jim, we'll look at some of your survey results for what you found with this, but I want to talk about what happens often when people talk at the dinner table when things get contentious or chat online chats or whatever. It seems like in an uncontrolled environment, the tendency is to not come together, but to push ourselves further apart. Can you talk about that?
Yes. In ordinary life, well, I think, first of all, we have an impression that we're even more divided than we are, and our results certainly show that we're divided. that we're even more divided because the people who tend to speak up are the people who feel the strongest. E.J. Dionne years ago wrote a book, Why Americans Hate Politics. And it was because, in part, when they do talk about politics, it becomes very unpleasant because it's a lot easier to talk about the weather than to dredge up a lot of issues that people disagree strongly about. But under moderated conditions, where people understood the idea was to communicate in a civil manner, turns out they have a lot to say to each other that's thoughtful and that gets beyond the kind of triggering points that you get from the cable news and the sort of partisan cues. We didn't give them the partisan cues. We didn't say this proposal was from Democrats or from candidate X, or this proposal was from Republicans or candidate Y. We said, you know, what do you think of this proposal? And here's some arguments for and against. And then they talked about the merits. They actually listened to each other. And they showed something with the most important thing. The opinion changes are very dramatic. But the most important thing, in my view, is they changed for identifiable reasons. And in doing so, they became more informed and they showed that the public is smart. I've got lots of colleagues who have made great careers about how stupid the public is. But in fact, the public is not stupid at all. The public only seems stupid because people tune out and they know everybody's trying to manipulate them and they don't think their voice matters. But if you participate in a situation where you think your voice does matter and the information is there, and the ground rules are there, people are collectively pretty smart. In fact, they're wise even.
Talking to James Fishkin from Stanford University about America in One Room, bringing together hundreds of Americans from across the political spectrum to learn and talk about political issues and what happens when people do this, when we talk about politics in a civil setting. James, what kind of things did you see when it came to how people change their minds pre and post America in One Room?
Well, one of the things that was interesting, as I said, we had all these different issues. We had immigration, we had taxes, we had health care, issues that are really current in the public discussion. So the thing that was very surprising, and because we had this pre-post control group so we can compare the changes in the public with the changes in the, we had a lot of statistical precision in evaluating the changes. So if you look just, for example, at the, start with the Republicans, the support for these proposals on the, that were more on the right, those support for those lessened, and support among the Republicans and support for the most progressive proposals on the left, lessened among Democrats. It wasn't as much the independents who moved as the partisans of the two major parties. So, for example, listen to this: support for forcing undocumented immigrants to return to their home countries before applying to live and work in the U.S. before deliberation, at the same in the control group. It was 79% of Republicans supported that, but after deliberation, only 40% supported that of Republicans. That's a 39-point drop among Republicans. And support for reducing the number of refugees allowed to settle in the U.S. among Republicans was 66% before deliberation and 34% afterwards. And support for more visas for low-skilled workers among Republicans, only 31% before deliberation wanted any more of that, but 66% after. And there were reasons, you know, people could understand the need for more low-skilled workers in agriculture and the hospitality industry, and having the undocumented immigrants return home when they question the experts. They realized the idea of getting in line and waiting your turn was a little bit of a fantasy when it could, depending on the country you're applying from, it could take decades to get processed, or certainly many years. It varies by country. but there wasn't an effective line. There needed to be some other solution for the 11 million undocumented immigrants. So these are big changes of opinion. And part of it, I think, is while there were no undocumented immigrants in the sample, because the sample was a sample of registered voters, there were a lot of people in the sample who knew undocumented immigrants or who were the children of immigrants or who had been immigrants at one time themselves, at least enough to for those perspectives to be included in the discussion. And so I think very often what happens when people do change opinions, and these are in confidential questionnaires, so the people never had to say to other people, I changed my mind, although some of them did when interviewed on camera. But it was confidential questionnaires like secret ballots. People change their opinion, I think, partly through some combination of the rational considerations and also empathy. All of a sudden, looking at the problem from the standpoint of other people who are affected by it. And that's a kind of part of moral reasoning, too, isn't it? Do unto others, et cetera, et cetera.
Talking to Jim Fishkin, director of the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford. We're talking about an event he hosted last month that got hundreds of people from all over America and all across the political spectrum together to discuss some hot button issues. We'll bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My real question for your guest would be, I have found it amazing that when we do have discussions with people, whether they agree or disagree, you find that people are more centrist than what the news media appears to be. And as such, I sometimes wonder why there aren't more centrist candidates in the electoral process. Why can't we have, say, a conservative financial president candidate who is also liberal socially? I find that just the dearth of centrist candidates to be lacking, and I'm wondering why that is.
Charlie, thanks for the call. And Jim, we've had people try to run as centrists, and it doesn't really seem to go very far lately.
Usually not, although President Macron in France ran as an enthusiastic centrist and surprised everybody by how well he did. But generally, the passion tends to be more on the extreme. I don't really want to like to use the term extreme because I don't want to stigmatize anybody. But on the people who are farther on the right or farther on the left, that's where the passion is. And we have the impression that people are generally more polarized because it's the people with the passion who speak up and who show up, and they give a somewhat distorted impression of public opinion. But the other thing is, the people who speak for the people, who the talking heads on cable news and the rest, they will tend to have stronger opinions, and they give that impression. And I learned a long time ago that if you take a random sample of the public, they may have similar views to the rest, to the people who speak for them, but they're not going to be so entrenched. We discovered that in Northern Ireland when we did deliberative democracy projects with Protestants and Catholics. And the ordinary people were much more open to discussion than the people who lead the organizations that speak for the various sectarian groups there. And we found the same in other countries, too. And that's, in a way, what we found here. If in order to make your point, make your case, you need money, organization, and intensity, and sometimes those things go along with having views that are farther on the right or farther on the left.
Charlie, thanks for the call. We'll go to Mike now in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi.
Hi. So, Rob, I feel like we need to stop. It doesn't matter which political party you're from or what you identify with. People need to stop attacking each other over their views. There's a study that they discussed on the BBC, and they said when someone's attacked about their views, they actually become more entrenched in their views. What we need to do is, I feel, we need to stop attacking. We need to take the time. And if we expect to be heard, we also have to be willing to listen to the other person's point in a non-hostile, non-aggressive manner, so that they feel that they're being heard and so that there's actually a dialogue as opposed to a monologue of the talking heads from each of the respective political corners.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Jim, I know this is something you try to deal with in your sessions of deliberative democracy. How do you keep that kind of attack and getting the hackles up out of it as much as you can?
Well, Mike is exactly right, and he said it very eloquently. I think that, first of all, when we have experts or politicians, they're not allowed to give speeches. They're only allowed to respond to the questions from the small groups that the small groups develop. Secondly, in the small groups, we encourage civility and listening, and we make sure that the moderators make sure, without giving any hint of their own positions, the moderators make sure that that there's roughly equal participation and equal talking time. And we talk about the merits of the issue, and we try to discourage any finger-pointing. When we did, in different cultures, sometimes it's different. I remember when we did the first national project that we did in Australia, which was on the question of whether Australia should get rid of the monarchy and become a republic, my Australian colleagues thought it was a matter of course that they made these big signs and put them in every room, and it's the sign said, "No personal insults," which I think was saying something about Australian culture, political culture. But it fit very much with Mike's comment. And we don't make those signs anymore, but we do have the moderators express some ground rules for the discussion. And people usually take to them very easily because they know how to be civil if that's the ground rule, and they all benefit from it because then they get listened to as well as having speaking time.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jim Fishkin from Stanford University, talking about deliberative democracy. He recently, among many other projects, got hundreds of Americans across the political spectrum together at an event last month and found people wanted to be heard and wanted to listen to what other people had to say. And Jim, apart from the survey results, when you did this event last month, when you've done them elsewhere from Mongolia to Australia and elsewhere in the world, do you feel a hunger for this? Do people feel a need for a venue like this to have these kind of conversations?
Oh, yes. This is, and this is maybe even more now than ever, because people feel that our democracies are coming apart. The divisions are producing deadlock. We're not getting anything done. We're going through life misunderstanding each other. So all of these projects generate increases in interpersonal trust and mutual respect. The percentage of people thinking that those on the other side, they may disagree with them, but they have good reasons for what for their viewpoint. And I think this is the glue of civil society that's being unglued. I don't know what the right metaphor is when glue gets taken apart or gets the glue in our social fabric. Boy, I'm mixing metaphors.
But our
social fabric is coming apart, and I think that civil discussion with diverse others, not just is a prized quantity, because the so much of our politics is about mobilizing the already convinced, and just trying to appeal to your base and leaving the others out. And I think we need to and those people tend to be similar. And so the question is, how can you have civil dialogue across diversity and understand at least what the concerns are of others? And people get very surprised because one of the nice things about America in One Room, which you can just Google and find the results and the different all the stuff about it, was that we had the whole country in one room, rural, urban, young, old, all political persuasions, and we can go through every demographic in every category and show that how representative it was in, by comparing to the control group, how representative it was in all the political viewpoints. So everybody was there in microcosm. And so you could actually see public opinion taking shape, which is why I was grateful to the New York Times for publishing a supplement with the photos of all the people I hope you don't mind my mentioning another media organization. But what they did was very unusual, because when I started years ago in Britain in 1994, when we did the first one of these, my British partner, a collaborator, said, when they gathered, he said, look at that sample. I wasn't quite sure why he wanted me to. He said, he grabbed my arm and said, look at them. I've selected thousands of random samples, but I've never seen one. No one has ever seen one. Because why? Because if you gathered them together, they might talk to each other. They might learn from each other.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Jim Fishkin, Janet Ampeck, Chair of International Communication, Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. He talked with us about last month's America in One Room event that brought people together from all over the country to deliberate on some of our most polarizing issues.